Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Mikhail Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita. Wow. It's not just a novel, is it? It feels more like this act of incredible defiance, almost artistic survival.
Absolutely. And we're diving into a bunch of sources today looking at this masterpiece, a book so, well, so dangerous it had to be kept hidden for decades.
And Bulgakov himself. A doctor, wasn't he?
A physician, yes.
Yeah.
And he was living and writing under just about the worst conditions you can imagine for an artist. We're talking Stalin's Soviet Union, absolute tyranny.
So his whole creative life was just this constant battle.
A suffocating fight, really, yeah. Against censorship, against persecution. You can't really get The Master of Margarita without understanding that background. It's the work of someone who basically chose truth, chose art over his own safety.
Right. And the novel itself reflects that complexity. It's like it is a crazy mix, part surreal satire of Soviet life.
Yeah, the bureaucracy is just skewered.
Part historical fiction, that whole Pontius Pilate story.
Very intense retelling, yeah.
Part deep philosophical discussion, and then there's this heartbreaking love story running through it all.
It really does operate on like three different levels at once.
Exactly. So our mission today, let's try and unpack those layers. You've got the Moscow chaos, the Master and Margarita story, and that ancient Pilate narrative. Uh-huh. What's the core message here? What's it telling us about courage, maybe, or cowardice?
Okay, let's do it. It kicks off spectacularly. Moscow, 1930s, mm-hmm. A city that's supposed to be this workers' paradise, but is actually tangled up in red tape and enforced atheism.
And the setting is specific, right? Yeah. Katriak's Ponds.
Very specific.
Where?
A real place. And there we meet Berlioz, who's this pompous literary editor, and Ivan Bezdomny, a young, not very good poet. They're just sitting there chatting about how God definitely doesn't exist. Very standard Soviet stuff.
Totally comfortable in their official atheism, and then boom.
Then Professor Willen arrives, the ultimate outsider, claims he's a specialist in black magic.
Which just sounds ridiculous on the face of it.
Completely. And he immediately starts messing with their heads. He's like, oh, God exists, obviously. And by the way, I had breakfast with Kant.
Just throws it out there, and then the prediction.
Ah, yes. The really chilling part. He calmly tells Berlioz exactly how he's going to die. Mm-hmm. Decapitated by a tramp.
And it happens just like that.
Moments later. It's shocking.
Yeah.
And that sudden, incredibly precise, violent death is like the opening chord of the whole symphony. It completely destroys Ivan Bezdomny's sense of reality.
You can imagine. He tries to chase Woland, right? This frantic, kind of comical chase.
Totally frantic. Totally absurd. And it leads directly to him being locked up in a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
He's just broken, utterly confused because logic itself seems to have dissolved.
But Woland, he's not just here to cause random chaos, is he? He's got an agenda.
Oh, definitely. The sources often describe him as sort of cosmic judge or maybe an auditor. He and his bizarre entourage.
That crew is something else. Korovyev, the weird tall one.
The sort of foppish one, yeah. And Behemoth.
The giant talking gun-toting cat.
Can't forget Behemoth. And as Zello the fanged sort of hitman and Hello the vampire, they move into apartment 50.
Which has this reputation, right? The cursed apartment.
Exactly. And from there, they basically conduct what one analysis called an infernal audit of Moscow.
An infernal audit. I like that. So they're exposing the rot.
Precisely. They don't create the sin. They just pull back the curtain on the greed, the hypocrisy, the moral emptiness that's already there in Soviet society. Like that famous magic show scene.
At the Variety Theater. Brilliant.
Isn't it? They shower the audience with money.
Everyone goes wild grabbing it.
And then later, poof, it turns into bottle labels or something worthless.
Mm.
And the fancy Parisian dresses they conjure up for the women, they vanish, leaving them all standing there in their underwear.
Yeah.
It's hilarious, but also deeply pointed.
It's fascinating because Woland, the devil figure, is actually acting as this strange agent of justice. He's punishing all the things the atheist state pretends don't exist. Greed, vanity, lying.
He's filling a vacuum, you could say.
Yeah.
A moral vacuum left by a society that tried to legislate morality out of existence and replace it with, well, state directives.
Okay, so while all this chaos is erupting in Moscow, Ivan is in the asylum. And that's where the heart of the story really starts to emerge, isn't it?
Yes, that's where Ivan meets the master. And the master is, well, he's the novel's core. Its soul, maybe.
He's a writer, or was.
He's described as a historian, initially.
Wow.
Brilliant guy, but completely broken. He tells Ivan his story, his tragedy. He poured his entire life into writing this incredible, deeply felt novel about Pontius Pilate and Yeshua HaNatzri, that's Jesus.
Okay.
But the literary establishment, this official writers union called Masalit, they just tore it to shreds, attacked it viciously, called it religious propaganda, basically destroyed his reputation.
Ah, so it mirrors Bulgakov's own struggle.
Correctly. The master becomes this heartbreaking symbol of the true artist, the person of integrity, just crushed and silenced by a totalitarian regime. And in his despair, his fear, he burned the manuscript.
He burned his own novel. Oh, that's devastating.
It is. And this is how Bulgakov introduces that third narrative strand we mentioned, the master's novel itself. We get chapters from it woven into the main story.
The story of Pilate.
Yes, and it's told from Pilate's perspective. It's incredibly psychological, focusing on his inner torment, his migraines, his guilt. It becomes this intense exploration of cowardice, really.
Yeah.
That's the central question there.
Wow. So you have the Moscow chaos, the master's tragedy, and this ancient story of Pilate all running in parallel.
Exactly. And while the master has given up, essentially rotting away in the asylum, there's Margarita.
His lover.
His passionate, devoted lover. She's the driving force, really, stuck in this empty, loveless marriage to some scientist. But she's consumed by grief for the master and refuses to believe he's gone forever. She has this unwavering hope.
She sounds like the complete opposite of the master's despair.
She absolutely is. She embodies, you know, absolute love, absolute loyalty, maybe the only pure thing left in that version of Moscow. Which, of course, makes her the perfect candidate for Wolin's intervention.
So the devil comes calling for her, too.
As Zello approaches her.
Uh-huh.
Makes her an offer from Wolin. Help us, and we'll help you find the master.
A classic Faustian bargain.
Pretty much. And does she hesitate?
I'm guessing not.
Not for a second. She accepts immediately. As Zello gives her this mysterious cream.
The magic cream.
Right. She rubs it on, and she's transformed. She becomes young again, beautiful, powerful. And she can fly. She becomes a witch.
And she flies over Moscow. That must be an incredible sequence.
It's pure liberation. Just soaring above the city that crushed her lover. And what's the first thing she does with her new power?
Let me guess. Revenge.
You got it. She finds the apartment of Lutinsky, the critic who led the charge against the master's novel. And she just destroys the place. Smashes windows, floods it. It's cathartic and kind of terrifying.
Okay, so she's embraced this dark power. Where does that lead?
It leads to the absolute centerpiece of the novel's Moscow plot, Satan's Grand Ball.
The Satan's Grand Ball.
The one and only. Wolin needs a queen for the ball, a hostess. And Margarita, because of her royal bloodline, or so they claim, and her courage, is chosen.
So she has to host a party for demons.
For the damned, basically. History's greatest sinners, murderers, tyrants, poisoners, traitors, they all parade past her. She has to stand there naked, greeting them all for hours. It's this grotesque, exhausting ordeal.
But she does it.
She does it with incredible strength and grace.
Yeah.
She endures it, and that grace is important.
Oh, so?
Because even amidst all this hellishness, she shows compassion. After the ball is over, Wolin offers her one wish, anything she wants, as a reward.
The master's return.
That's what you'd expect, right? But before she can ask for herself, she remembers this other soul she met at the ball, Frida, a woman cursed to eternally find the handkerchief she used to suffocate her baby. Margarita spontaneously uses her wish to ask Wolin to free Frida from her torment.
Wow. She uses her one wish for someone else.
A completely selfless act. And because she did that, because she showed that compassion first, Wolin is sort of obligated, maybe even impressed. He grants her a real wish, too.
Which is the master.
Instantly, the master appears beside her. Reunited, but the manuscript,
yeah,
it's still burned, right?
Ah, yes, the burned novel.
And this is maybe the most famous moment. Wolin looks at the master's despair over his destroyed work, and he produces the novel, intact, restored.
No.
And he delivers that iconic line, manuscripts don't burn.
Chills. Just chills. Oh. The idea that truth, that art, can't actually be destroyed by fire or by tyrants.
It's Bulgakov's ultimate act of defiance written into the heart of the story.
So they're reunited, the manuscript is back, happily ever after.
Not quite on this earth. Their earthly story is over. Wolin's crew gives them a dose of poisoned wine. It's presented as a release, not a punishment, and their souls are freed.
And they fly again.
They take one last flight, yes.
Mm-hmm.
With Wolin and his whole retinue soaring over Moscow, leaving that world behind.
And this is where the different narrative threads really come together.
Absolutely. As they're flying, Matthew the Levite appears.
From the master's novel, Yeshua's disciple.
The very same. He comes as a messenger from Yeshua. He tells Woland that Yeshua has read the Master's novel.
Wow.
And Yeshua's request is that the Master and Margarita shouldn't be taken into the light, perhaps because the Master faltered, burned his work, despaired, but should be granted peace, rest.
Peace, not light.
Right.
Interesting distinction.
It is. And this leads to the final act of redemption in the story. Woland takes the Master to Pontius Pilate.
To Pilate, who's been suffering all this time.
For 2,000 years, trapped on this desolate mountain ledge, tormented by his guilt, his cowardice, dreaming always of finishing his conversation with Yeshua.
And the Master can free him.
Yes. The Master, the artist, is given the power to complete his own story, the one Pilate is trapped within. He cries out to Pilate, telling him he's free now.
Art itself provides the absolution.
Exactly. The truth told in the Master's novel releases Pilate from his eternal punishment. We see Pilate finally walk off along a moonlit path, joining Yeshua. It's an incredibly powerful moment about art's redemptive power.
And what about the Master and Margarita? What is their piece?
They are led to their final reward, an eternal home. It's described as this peaceful, idyllic little house with vines, Venetian windows, a place for quiet, for love, for the Master to write, undisturbed, forever, away from all the noise and fear and corruption of the world.
So they find their sanctuary. Okay, that covers the incredible plot. Let's shift gears a bit then. What are the big takeaways? The philosophical core. You mentioned cowardice early.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely central. Cowardice is the gravest sin. That seems to be Bulgakov's fundamental moral argument here.
More than malice. More than greed.
It seems so. Look at Pilate. Why did he condemn Yeshua? Not because he hated him. Not really. It was fear. Fear for his job. Fear of Rome. Fear of upsetting the status quo. That failure to act on his conscience. That prioritizing of personal security over truth. That's presented as the ultimate damning failure.
And the Master mirrors that in a way.
Exactly. He burns his novel out of fear. Fear of the state. Fear of the critics. Fear of the consequences. He abandons his artistic truth. Bulgakov draws a direct line across two millennia. This failure of moral courage is the most profound sin. Choosing silence, choosing safety when you should speak or act, that's the path to damnation, or at least profound suffering.
That's a heavy message. And it connects to Woland's role too, doesn't it? This idea of good and evil not being so simple.
Definitely. That's the second huge theme, the interdependence of good and evil. Woland actually defends his own necessity.
And he gives that speech, right?
Yeah.
About shadows.
Yes. The famous quote, "What would your good do if evil did not exist? And what would the earth look like if all the shadows disappeared from it?" He argues that shadows are cast by things, by people. You can't have light without shadow.
So he's arguing that evil, or his function at least, is necessary for good to even have meaning.
Pretty much. It's a challenge to any simplistic view. Moscow in the novel tried to get rid of God, tried to eliminate the light of traditional morality and conscience. And what happens? Woolen, the shadow, has to step in to expose the hypocrisy and corruption that flourishes in that vacuum. He's restoring a kind of balance almost.
It's like the system created its own antibodies in a perverse way.
You could see it like that. The state denies sin. Woolen arrives to punish it. The satire works because the supernatural chaos he unleashes often feels less absurd than the actual bureaucratic reality of Soviet life that Bulgakov is critiquing, the housing shortages, the constant fear, the denunciations, the official lies.
The talking cat starts to seem almost normal compared to the rest of it.
Almost. But ultimately, even with the devil taking center stage, the novel feels like it champions the human spirit, doesn't it?
It does. Through Margarita, mostly.
Yes, through her love. Her unwavering, selfless love is the force that ultimately earns them peace. Remember, she used her wish for Frida first. That compassion, that courage in the face of literal hell is the redemptive act.
And it circles back to that line.
Manuscripts don't burn. It's the ultimate statement of hope for the artist, for truth itself. Bulgakov himself was writing this, knowing it might never be published, knowing the risks. He poured his belief into that line that tyrants can burn books, they can silence people, but they can't destroy the truth or the art that carries it. It will survive. It will find a way.
It's incredible how a story with such fantastical elements, the devil, witches, a flying pigman, okay, maybe not a pigman, but the cat, still feels so deeply relevant.
Because at its heart, it's about choices we all face, isn't it? The choice between courage and cowardice, between integrity and expediency, between love and despair.
It definitely challenges you to think about your own moral compass and affirms that maybe love, that kind of selfless love, really is the most powerful force there is.
A story where the devil visits Moscow and ends up proving the power of love and the immortality of art.
Mm.
Yeah, That's why it sticks with you. A truly defiant, unforgettable masterpiece.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.